You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Tea Party movement takes its name from the Boston Tea Party, which took place in 1773. The implication is that the two movements share similar objectives. The new Tea Party has made its positions clear: cut taxes, reduce government spending, and the national debt. But in an article in the November issue of Vanity Fair called Debt and Dumb, Simon Johnson and James Quack argue that today's Tea Party is more akin to the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794, and that its objectives might even be in opposition to the will of the Founding Fathers. Simon Johnson is a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He's a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and James Quack is an associate professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a regular contributor to Vanity Fair. They are also co-founders of the Baseline Scenario, a popular blog about global economic matters, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
How are you? Hi, thanks for having us.
James, the title of this article, Dead and Dumb, can be seen as kind of insulting. Is it a good strategy to make your opinions clear so early?
Well, I'm not sure that, you know, our intention was to insult anyone. I think our intention was that the Tea Party movement, today has been laying claim to a certain notion of the Founding Fathers and what they meant for the scope of government, the power of the federal government, and the appropriate levels of spending and taxation. And our goal was simply to say that there are multiple sides to the story, and we think that, in fact, the views held by the Tea Party would not necessarily be so welcome to some of the key Founding Fathers, particularly Hamilton and President Washington.
Do the negative associations with taxes and credit go back very early in American political history?
So certainly there are negative associations with taxes. I think that, you know, certainly the American Revolution was in large part revolt about taxes. But I think the key principle here, and the principle that the Boston Tea Party was fought for, in a sense, was the principle that there should be no taxation without representation. So the idea was that the thing that actually triggered the Boston Tea Party was a change in taxes levied by Parliament, and the colonists in Boston wanted to reaffirm the principle that they would not accept taxes that were imposed by a Parliament in which they were not represented. Now, I think that taxation without representation is pretty much not an issue in the United States, mm-hmm. unless you live in Washington, D.C. And I think that the more important issue from the standpoint of the 1790s was, what would it take to make the United States economically prosperous and independent and powerful in the world? And I think at the time, as we talked about in the article, there are two main examples that they would have been looking at. One was Great Britain and one was France. And Great Britain had much better public credit, and that was largely because it had the ability, the legitimacy and the ability to impose and collect taxes, which France did not have. So I think that, you know, from the perspective of the Constitutional Convention and the first Washington administration, I think the lessons for America's first leaders were clear.
So, Simon, are the two of you suggesting that the British ultimately prevailed because they had an edge based on the way they levied taxes? Was that more important than being part of an alliance that overwhelmed Napoleon?
Yes, the British prevailed in their continental wars, the wars against France, primarily because they could raise a lot of money at short notice. They could pay a relatively low interest rate on that debt, and they could mobilize resources against a much bigger country, which was France. So the British had a secret weapon, if you like, and not one we think about a lot in these terms today. It was their debt.
And was Hamilton aware of this? Is this something he was that shaped his ideas?
Hamilton became painfully aware of the resources the British could bring to bear as he and Washington were beaten up and down the east coast of the United States over a period of years. And, of course, at the same time, Hamilton was also in charge of a lot of Washington's correspondence with the Continental Congress, where they were begging for any kind of resources and money or supplies to be provided. And that Continental Congress did not have the power of taxation. There was no federal power of taxation that meant anything at that time. And the army, the soldiers, really felt it. That's why so many of them died, for example, at Valley Forge under absolutely horrendous conditions.
You write that he learned his lesson because he was, during the time he was an artillery captain and then later as the first Secretary of the Treasury. France and the Netherlands lent money, troops, and ships to the United States. What did Hamilton conclude from that experience?
Well, I think he got the point that the U.S. was somewhat lucky to get these foreign loans, and you couldn't expect that kind of advantage to be available indefinitely. He also, I think, and many other founding fathers felt the same way, including Thomas Jefferson, that it would be very easy for the new country to become a pawn in some big international games of chess run by these European countries that were very powerful and had large navies. So they didn't want to do that. They wanted to find ways to stay independent and without a sufficient ability to defend yourself, including the fiscal ability and legitimacy of being able to tax people. It's very hard to stay independent.
So, James, let's assume that not all of our listeners remember everything they learned in their high school history classes. What led to the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794?
So it depends how far back you want to go, but let's start with 1790-91. So one of the questions that the first Congress faced was what to do about the debts that both the federal government and the states had taken on fighting the revolution and had not been able to pay back during the 1780s. And Hamilton, as the first Secretary of the Treasury, his proposal, which was eventually passed, was for the federal government to assume the debts, meaning that it would take on the obligation of paying back these debts. And in order to do that, he used the new powers in the Constitution to levy some new taxes within the country. So at this point, there's no income tax. Most taxes are raised either by taxes on foreign trade or taxes on internal commerce.
In fact, the federal income tax, which is a sore point with the Tea Party people, wasn't enacted until 1913.
The current amendment, that's correct. The point was to dedicate these taxes in part to paying the interest on the debt that the United States had assumed. Now, there's some controversy about whether Hamilton ever wanted to pay off the debt or not. But leaving that aside, this is actually very similar to what Great Britain had done in the 18th century. So every time they fought a war, they borrowed a lot of money, and then they raised taxes, and they dedicated some of those tax revenues to paying back the money they had borrowed to fight this war. Now, the whiskey tax was unpopular, especially in frontier states, for a number of reasons. One is that, you know, people don't like paying taxes, although in this case it's interesting because a whiskey tax is the kind of tax you can usually pass on to your customers. But leaving that aside, some of it was purely economic. Some of it was that people felt like they were being stepped on by big government in the East Coast, and there may have been some merit to this. So to some extent you do have, you know, East Coast elites who are taxing Western farmers. Again, this is before you could have an income tax or a progressive income tax. So beginning in 1792, I believe, there was resistance to the tax, which smoldered for a couple of years and finally broke out in 1794 when there were attempts to intimidate tax collectors and federal representatives in Pennsylvania. So that set the stage, and there was a debate within the Washington administration about what to do. Hamilton was the most enthusiastic, let's say, about calling up a militia and suppressing the rebellion by force. Washington was more circumspect, but eventually did agree to the idea of calling out the militia, and the militia went out to Pennsylvania, and the rebels largely melted away. A few people were tried and convicted and eventually pardoned by Washington.
And then the country came to accept the new taxes?
Well, that remained an important political debate. So to the extent that you can say, it's hard to say that a country always accepts the outcome of a conflict. For a long time, the history of this event was very celebratory in saying this was a wonderful thing, and Americans decided that this is the way things should be. There was still, so on the one hand, I think that it cemented the idea that the federal government had the power to levy and collect taxes. Now, there was still a debate about whether the taxes were good policy, and When Thomas Jefferson became president, his administration repealed some of these taxes that Hamilton had levied. That debate, I think, went on until the War of 1812. The interesting thing about the War of 1812 in our story is by this point, James Madison is president, and he had been allied with Jefferson and an opponent of Hamilton in the 1790s. In 1812, we declared war on Great Britain, without bothering essentially to raise taxes to pay for the war, and we were doing pretty badly. We were losing battles in Canada, most notably in 1814, most of the federal buildings in Washington were burned by the British. And as a result of this experience, the Madison administration then went and levied some of the same taxes that Hamilton had levied in the 1790s. So I think that in that sense, the lesson came home that power depends on credit, which depends on taxes.
Well, it sounds like something similar to what happened more recently, where the United States started two wars and lower taxes at the same time. My guests are James Quack and Simon Johnson, co-authors of an article called Debt and Dumb. It's in the current issue of Vanity Fair. This is WNYC. So why do you think they call themselves the Tea Party Movement instead of the Whiskey Rebellion Movement?
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious. Obviously, the Tea Party is an event that has important connotations in our history and is generally celebrated. The Whiskey Rebellion is not. I think that's the most clear reason. You know, I think that it's not.
It was good PR, wasn't it?
Exactly. I mean, I don't think we want to say that they are 100% Whiskey Rebellion and 0% Tea Party. I mean, there are strands, there are, you know, overlaps and conflicting strands in American history. I think that, you know, to the extent that the Tea Party was a revolt against what was felt as an intrusive foreign government, intrusive faraway government that was not accountable to the people. There's certainly something of that in the modern day Tea Party. But I think that the main contrast we would draw is that the Tea Party today, I think a lot of scholars have looked at this and are pretty skeptical about the idea that it's a authentic grassroots movement that sprang up in the last 2 years. I think that, you know, on inspection, it really looks more like the latest phase of what I would call a conservative tax revolt that goes back about 35 years. The idea being that we want to roll back the federal government, we want to reduce its power, and the way to do that is to cut off revenues. This often goes by the name of the Starve the Beast strategy.
The Grover Norquist approach.
Exactly. And I think that particular policy position is more reflective of the Whiskey Rebellion than of the Boston Tea Party.
But Simon, William Hoagland, who published a book about the Whiskey Rebellion with Simon & Schuster, says, I'm quoting, "The Whiskey Rebels were not anti-tax, anti-federalist, or anti-central government. What they said they objected to about the whiskey tax is that it did not operate in proportion to property. That is, they wanted what they called equal taxation. Some even wanted progressive taxation," which sounds a lot closer to the Occupy Wall Street protesters' arguments, doesn't it?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about American populism, various kinds of popular revolts, is there are ideas from the right and ideas from the left. They get intermingled. And you may be right that some elements of the Whiskey Rebellion are picked up now in groups other than the Tea Party. But the Tea Party absolutely did challenge the legitimacy of the federal government with regard to collecting taxes. Albert Gallatin was an advisor to them, and a very interesting figure. He went on to become leader of the Congressional Republicans. He was Secretary of the Treasury under Jefferson and Madison. He worked hard to try and roll back what Hamilton had done, and he found in the War of 1812 that it went very badly for the federal government when they didn't have the resources they need in order to stave off their foreign enemies.
The Republican candidates who are running for president think that the government's powers far exceeded the intent of the founding fathers. You're suggesting that the founding fathers didn't agree on it either, so we have to pick and choose the founding fathers that we cite as our models, don't we?
Well, I think our view more precisely is that there was obviously this classic debate, and a debate that's been repeated many times, between Hamilton on the one side and Jefferson and Madison on the other side about the power of the federal government. But in the War of 1812, which came after the Republicans, the party most closely associated with Jefferson, and they'd been in power for 12 years, and Madison was at that point the president, they found that their way of running things led to dire military consequences. And it was Gallatin and other people, Henry Clay, also coming from the Republican movement, who moved, I think, the consensus much closer to that of Hamilton. We're not 100% Hamilton in this country. We have our reservations, and Hamilton himself had some weaknesses, I would say, including his views on banking, for example. But we moved much closer to Hamilton than to Jefferson on all these economic policy issues, in large part because it went so badly in the War of 1812.
My guests are Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and James Quack, an associate professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law, regular contributor to Vanity Fair. They are also co-founders of the Baseline Scenario, which is a blog about the global economy. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Simon Johnson of MIT and James Quack of the University of Connecticut School of Law, co-founders of the Baseline Scenario, which is a blog about the global economy. Did this article grow out of things that you've been writing about in your blog?
So a couple of things. I mean, certainly in the past year or so, we've been focusing more on, you know, American fiscal policy issues like the deficit, the long-term debt, the debt ceiling debate, and so on. Because I think that, first of all, you know, the blog, for a couple of years, we focused mainly on the financial crisis, which is what we wrote our first book about. And in a sense, the fiscal challenges the U.S. is facing today are really the sequel. I mean, I think that it's pretty clear that in the short term, the reason we're having these debates about government spending and taxes and the deficit is because of the financial crisis. So the recession that it caused, and that for many practical purposes is still going on, has caused a huge collapse in government tax revenues. It's also required increased spending on a lot of the social safety net programs that the government has, such as they are. And that's why deficits have spiked so high right now, and why there's been so much chatter about the national debt. So in a sense, this problem is a very direct follow-on to the financial crisis.
Simon, over the summer, there was a standoff between Democrats and Republicans over raising the debt limit, and the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party was against raising the debt ceiling. Following that drawn-out struggle, Standard & Poor's downgraded the U.S. credit rating. So what did that downgrade mean? Is it a judgment on our economy or on our government? Are they linked, or is that just something that was brushed aside, as so many politicians did?
Well, I don't think the downgrade by itself is particularly a big deal. I think Standard & Poor's made a bad call on that one, personally. But there's no question that the debate over the shutdown and whether or not to pay the debt in full, which was very much a serious part of the discussion in July and August, that was about whether the legitimacy of the federal government in the fiscal sphere. If you've contracted debt, should you pay them? And there are people, and people I talk to on the right of the Republican Party, who felt that the government should not be paying all of its debts in that previously agreed fashion. And this is a fascinating point and a throwback, really, to the beginning of the Republic. Does the federal government have the power and the legitimacy to raise taxes? Should it service all the debts that have been contracted for various reasons? Or should you go down a very different path of public finance?
But Republicans and Democrats alike have raised taxes when we had an increased debt. In fact, this morning I heard some speeches from Ronald Reagan in which he said that he felt that the wealthy should pay their fair share, and then he raised taxes. He's cited often as one of the role models of the Tea Party Republicans. Are they misreading Republican history?
Well, this is a wonderful question and a very interesting issue, because Ronald Reagan, I think, in a sense, ideologically, I think is, you know, could be claimed as a father of the Tea Party. I mean, I think in the 1960s, as governor of California and as a candidate in the 1970s, he was very clear that he wanted to roll back the federal government, cut spending drastically, lower taxes, get the government out of your life, and so on. But I think what's interesting is about the 1980s, when he was actually president, is he was actually quite pragmatic. So in 1981, there was a massive tax cut, biggest tax cut in probably in American history. The deficit shot up. And then starting in 1982, Reagan worked with Bob Dole, who was a Republican Senate leader, and he worked with Tip O'Neill in the House, who was a Democrat, to, if not solve the deficit problem, at least to try to keep it under control. And they raised taxes several times. In 1982, in 83, the Social Security Agreement had a tax increase in it. 84, in 86, they enacted comprehensive tax reform. 87, there was another tax increase. So this was a period when, even though Reagan was president, the center of gravity in the Republican Party was still in favor of some degree of fiscal responsibility. And I think that has faded since then.
Do you think that the Tea Party Republicans were just standing up for the principles that got them elected? Either of you want to handle that? Because that's what they're saying. They ran on that platform, and then they didn't want to renege on their promises.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. That's another good question. I mean, I think individually, there's certainly an argument to be made in favor of what the Tea Party politicians are doing, which is exactly as you said. I mean, this is what the people want. I won the election by promising for this. I'm going to follow through in Washington. And I don't think, you know, I don't think that's dishonest or evil or anything like that. I think that more fundamentally what we're talking about is the wisdom of this policy position to begin with. And so the Tea Party, obviously, there's a set of politicians in Washington. There's also a broad-based movement, which is, you know, partly grassroots and partly funded by traditional Republican operatives and billionaires. And I think that that this movement is about, in a sense, reducing the legitimacy of the federal government and making it possible to defund the government and roll back its operations. And that I think, is more what we're worried about. Whether a given freshman congressman who was elected with Tea Party support should be doing what he's doing is really up to him or her.
What's the role of Treasury bonds in modern America, Simon?
Well, the debt issued by the U.S. Treasury has been regarded correctly as one of the safest investments that you can have, not just in the United States, but around the world. So if you were to renege on the debt or to create the possibility that this debt would not be paid, you would be plunged into the kind of crisis that they have now in Europe. But for various reasons, the people in financial markets, investors, are concerned about whether countries, not just Greece, Portugal, and Ireland, but also countries like Italy, will pay their debts. Italy is the third largest bond market in the world, after the United States and Japan. So if you remove the prevailing certainty about government debts being paid, you really fundamentally undermine the base of a modern economy.
Well, after the Standard & Poor's downgrade, the interest rates of our country acted differently than other countries that are in the same position. Is that because we're seen as having a more stable economy throughout the world?
Well, in part. Partly it's because the Standard & Poor's downgrade created a lot of additional or a significant amount of additional risk and fear, and that led to so-called flight to quality. So people abandoned assets that they thought were relatively more risky, and they ran into, of all things, yes, U.S. Government securities. So the price of those bonds went up, and the interest rate moves inversely to the price of those bonds, so that the interest rate goes down. We benefit from being a safe haven, at least at this point in global economic history. So anything that destabilizes the world in a big macroeconomic sense helps the United States, pushes down our short-term interest rate. It's rather perverse, and I'm not suggesting it's the great long-term solution to any problem, but it is the dynamic that we saw playing out in August.
My guests are Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, now a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and James Kwak, an associate professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law, regular contributor to Vanity Fair. They wrote an article for Vanity Fair called Debt and Dumb for the current issue. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. By the way, we have a link to that article on our show page at wnyc.org. The Occupy Wall Street people are saying that they represent 99% of the population, but the polls indicate that the Tea Party is popular with 1 out of 4 Americans. That means a lot of people who are not millionaires are all supporting it. Do you have any idea why?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why people support the Tea Party. I mean, one is that this kind of anti-government populism has been popular there have been strains of it in American history for a long time, certainly all the way back to the beginning. I think, there's also a moral element, I think, to the Tea Party argument. So Theda Scotch-Paul and two of her co-authors, Scotch-Paul is a sociologist at Harvard, And two co-authors did a study, and you know, one of the things they found was that a lot of people in the Tea Party are motivated by what they see as a dichotomy between people who work and earn the fruits of their labor and people they see as hangers-on who don't pull their weight, don't do their fair share. So, you know, in American politics is a complicated thing. I think, you know, a lot of people do not vote their, say, their economic interests, and they're free not to vote their economic interests. And for many people, I think that, you know, moralistic considerations or even religious considerations in some place play an important role. And, you know, I'm not sure that Occupy Wall Street, say, represents 99% of Americans. But what I would say is that I think the key thing about the 99%, 1% divide is that I think the movement is responding to a lot of the problems of inequality and, frankly, poverty in this country that are best symbolized by the growing divide between the 1% and the 99%. Certainly, I don't think they would claim that, you know, 99% of Americans would agree with them.
But it seems to me that the people who these different movements are aiming themselves at are at wide variance. The Tea Party is going after government, and the Occupy Wall Street people are going after the financial sector. And some of the critics of the Occupy Wall Street people are saying, well, why aren't they going after the government? Are they misguided in this approach? Paul Krugman says that the protest is angry at the right people.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what it means to go after government. I think certainly people in Occupy Wall Street should be trying to get politicians to change their positions, and if that doesn't happen, they should be trying to vote out those politicians. I think that's a little different from being against government in general, which I think is closer to the position of the Tea Party. Now, as for being against finance and against corporations, you know, I do think that finance, particularly the Wall Street investment banks, bear a large amount of responsibility for the economic tough times we're going through today, and to some extent for the inequality that underlies the Occupy Wall Street movement. At the same time, though, I do think that the path to change in this country is through democratic politics. It's through government. So I think that, in a sense, you know, people in the Occupy Wall Street movement may be against Wall Street, but I agree in a sense that they should be focusing their efforts on change in Washington.
Well, the New Republic argues, and I'm quoting, just because liberals are frustrated with Wall Street does not mean that we should automatically find common cause with a group of people who are protesting Wall Street.
Well, hold on. It's not just the liberals who are frustrated with Wall Street. It's a lot of people, including people on the right of the political spectrum. I think some of the strongest, clearest statements are made about the problems emerging out of our current financial sector come from people like Gene Farmer of University of Chicago or John Cochran from University of Chicago. Farmer said that too big to fail is not a market. It's a government subsidy scheme, and it should end. He's absolutely right that there's nothing sensible about having six mega banks dominate your financial system and have the ability to blow themselves up, causing a massive recession and the loss of 8 million jobs. And this is not a populist point. This is an IMF-type point, that this is sensible economics against a massive vested elite. The Occupy Wall Street people are right on this point. The Tea Party people are right when they confront the bigness of the banks on this point. It's the people in Washington who refuse to move because of the money involved.
Critics of the Occupy Wall Street activists say that the Tea Party has pretty clearly defined goals, while OWS doesn't. Of course, OWS says, well, that's part of what our movement is all about. We don't have somebody telling us what we should be fighting for. We agree by consensus at some loosely defined goals. Is that the criticism of Occupy Wall Street fair, do you think?
So I don't think it's particularly fair. Thinking back to 2009, I could be wrong. I believe there was a phase in the first couple of months of the Tea Party when it was not clear that it would become an extreme conservative right-wing movement. It had, you know, it had a broader set of themes within the movement. But I think more importantly, from my perspective, and I have not been to Wall Street in the past few weeks, I see the Occupy Wall Street movement as a protest movement. It's a movement that is calling attention to some of the basic and very serious problems we have in this country, problems of, you know, inequality, problems of poverty, problems of lack of equal opportunity. broken healthcare system and so on. And I think that the most important, at least at this moment, the most important achievement has been bringing these issues onto the front pages of newspapers. And I think, you know, the Tea Party over time developed a platform, in part it developed a platform because of the influence of people like Dick Armey, the head of FreedomWorks and former majority leader in the House, playing a role in funding Tea Party organizations. So where Occupy Wall Street goes, I don't know, and I don't presume to say where it should go. But I think at this moment it's played an important role in helping to shift the agenda just a little bit.
Well, David Koch is not about to give any money to the Occupy Wall Street people. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We've been talking with James Kwak, Associate Professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a regular contributor to Vanity Fair, about an article in Vanity Fair that he co-wrote with Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management. The article is called Debt and Dumb, and it's in the current issue of the magazine. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.